Welcome back to The Stacks. My name is Tracy Thomas, and I am your host here. This week on The Stacks, we are discussing Maureen Orth's true crime book, Vulgar Favors, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. Before we get started, I just wanted to remind all of you to subscribe to The Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. And if you listen to us through iTunes, we would greatly appreciate any rating or review you give. Also, this week's episode is brought to you by our sponsor, Audible. Audible is a catalog for audiobooks with over 180,000 titles for you to choose from. Listeners of this show get a free 30-day trial and free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. It's completely free for 30 days, and you can pick any audiobook that you want. On today's episode of The Stacks, Broadway choreographer Sam Pinkleton is back. We discuss Maureen Orth's book, Vulgar Favors, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. This book tells the story of serial killer Andrew Cunanan, his life, his murders, and the death, of course, of Gianni Versace. Sam and I discuss this book, the crimes, but also we discuss the overall tone of this book. We look at the idea of gay crime and why that term, and so much more of this book, is more than a little problematic. There are spoilers this week, but since this book comes from true crime, there really isn't much for us to spoil. It happened in 1997, so the details are very much out there. Everything Sam and I discuss this week will also be found in the show notes. You can feel free to listen and then go back and check out some of the articles and books that are relevant. Okay, I'm done blabbing your ear off. It is time for my conversation with Sam Pinkleton on The Stacks Book Club. So thank you guys so much, and I hope you enjoy. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to The Stacks. It is I, your host, Tracy Thomas, and I'm joined again by choreographer and director Sam Pinkleton. And this week, we are doing our Stacks Book Club conversation about Maureen Orth's book, Vulgar Favors, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. Hi, Sam. Welcome back.
Hi, Tracy. Thanks for having me.
So for those of you who don't know anything about the book, basically the book is about Andrew Cunanan, who was a serial killer in 1997, who killed four men and then proceeded to kill another man who was very, very famous. And that man's name was Gianni Versace. And the book is Maureen Orth, who is a journalist. It is her deep dive into this murder spree and the life of Andrew Cunanan and the men that he murdered and, you know, kind of trying to put it all together. And I'm just going to say this right now from the beginning. The murders happened in 1997 and the book was published in 1999. So there is definitely a lack of scope or context given to a lot of the book, which I think is what Sam and I are going to mostly talk about, because reading the book almost 20 years later feels like there's a lot missing. So with that being said, Sam, why don't you tell me kind of like your general feelings or thoughts about the book?
Sure. I struggled with the book. What I really appreciated actually was, you know, the book is a deep dive. It's very clear that this woman is obsessed with this story. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting that she, you know, was writing for Vanity Fair and sort of started working on this piece about Cunanan. Cunanan?
You know what?
You say Cunanan. Yeah. started working on this piece for Vanity Fair. And as she was working on the piece, he kept killing. And so it became more and more interesting. And then she ended up actually being on the trail of the Versace moment, which was, you know, a 2-week manhunt, basically.
Sure.
So that kind of spiral is really interesting to me. And therefore, this book provided a fair amount of kind of historical context for a moment in, I would say, at this point, pop culture that I understood very little about.
Sure.
And that I'm very grateful for. That being said, it is a long book.
It could be 200 pages shorter.
Solidly 200
pages. It's 500
pages.
Yeah. And it could be 200 pages shorter. And I think that, so one of the things that is troubling for me about the book is that as a journalist, Maureen Orth goes and she interviews like tons of people. There are so many names in this book. You have no clue who's who.
At any point. Hundreds of gay people.
The only names that I actually am certain that I know who said what are Andrew Cunanan, Gianni Versace, and Donatella. Like, other than that,
yeah, it's just a bunch of people named Michael from
Michael,
San Diego.
David, like, Don, like Richard.
You have to kind of like draw a map of the people as you're reading.
We need like a web.
But then, I mean, I struggled with it so much as reporting because A, you're continuously like, wait, where are these sources coming from?
Who
and what is
people?
Verified? And also,
and how is it verified?
Yeah. And I think to your point, Tracy, about like this was written 20 years ago, you said this to me the other day. Like, I think that it's kind of written assuming that everyone is obsessed with this story. Mm-hmm. Everyone's coming to the story with some information, and also that this will be one of the great enduring crime stories of our time,
right.
Which it kind of isn't. I mean, I know right now there's that FX thing, right. So it's kind of back, but I just felt like there are so many things that were presented as super important and mm-hmm. people that you would care about, and then they kind of disappeared.
Right. Well, what's interesting, this is like totally not about the book, but something that I found that was really fascinating is that this happened in 1997 and it was a huge deal at the time. But about 6 weeks later, Princess Diana died, and she was connected to Versace. They were pals, and Elton John and this and that. And I think that it's crazy that people don't really talk about these two events connected to one another, but also that that really eclipsed this whole spree and this whole Andrew Cunanan thing, and that became the crime story of the year and of the next few years. Like, it had been OJ was before, then this happened, and everybody kind of thought this would be like the next OJ thing. And Maureen Orth is obsessed with OJ in this book. He comes up at least 10 times for no other reason than just to say, because of OJ, police do a bad job, or like, because of OJ, the news was there.
Yeah, it definitely reminded me, and it, of course, you can't help but think about the Vincent Bugliosi book Outrage, which we talked about, but it reminded me of how that OJ, the whole OJ moment, like, took our whole country hostage.
Sure.
And I feel like she's capitalizing on that, honestly.
She is. Like, she's,
I feel
like really, she's like, just name him.
She's like, I know that you only understand like celebrity crime, right, one way. So right. I'm just going to continuously try to frame this via, right, OJ.
And she's also obsessed in this book with celebrity things. She names so
for
many,
sure,
books and movies and TV shows, and Lisa Kudrow comes up, and Air Force One comes up, and there's like all these little references to she quotes Tupac at one point,
yeah,
about,
yeah,
Versace, and I'm like, this is so, you know.
Well, but she's also writing. I mean, she's writing about somebody who was also obsessed with the mm-hmm. celebrity, and somebody, sure, who was obsessed with, like, who would you give him an inch and he takes a mile in terms of anything that is buzzy and,
right,
and fancy.
Sure.
But I also think that, like, she's oddly accidentally guilty of that. I would love to know if she's conscious of that. But
right.
It does feel like the whole book kind of has this tone of like, one time I was at a party with Jennifer Aniston's cousin.
Sure. It's so weird. And it's hard to know if she's doing it on purpose or if that's her also just who she is,
yeah,
as like a pop culture writer. So obviously, well, so maybe not obvious. If you've not read the book, this book has a lot to do with gay culture. Now, one of the first questions that comes to my mind is, why is this woman writing this book about gay culture? Because it becomes pretty apparent pretty early on that she has, at best, a judgmental take on homosexuality, and at worst is disgusted by gay people.
Yeah.
It feels like that.
So reading this as a real live, authentic gay man,
In the flesh,
I am. Yeah, which,
in studio with a real gay person.
I don't want to scare anyone, but they're definitely. I mean, I sort of had two takes. One more optimistic than the other. One was, as you say, I was like, wow, we really. I feel like it definitely resonated differently to me as a gay person, which surprised me, honestly. And I was like, okay, so we're kind of just saying that, like, gay people as a culture are, in addition to mostly being or engaging with hustlers and like super into crystal meth, like also really only like sex obsessed and material obsessed
and
also
money obsessed
and also like obsessed. Very ashamed to be,
sure,
gay, like very ashamed to be,
sure,
gay. And so that was, you know, a bummer. Mm-hmm. And then I also thought, we've come a long way in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's no world where this book would be have the tone that it has now. No possible world. But also I kind of buy some of the communities that she's creating, especially she talks a lot about older, wealthy, closeted gay men.
Sure.
And that kind of secret network, which I'm obsessed with and would love to read a book about.
Yes.
If anybody has one.
Please send us your recommendations for closeted, older, wealthy gay men.
That's right. But I was like, oh, this is, I understand how these communities could exist and could feel this way. It's a bummer.
Right.
But I wanted to give her the credit of the moment we were in was one. I mean, one of the things that I think is really deeply sad, and I think probably true, is the way that the sort of continuous cycle throughout the book, because there were so many... Sorry. Okay. There were so many... not only victims, but also witnesses and friends of Cunanan who had a troublesome relationship talking to law enforcement,
right,
simply because it would out them.
Right.
You know.
And also to the reporters later on.
Yeah. Like two, maybe three of the victims of five were basically outed by being killed by Cunanan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we found out that Versace was HIV positive after
the
fact.
So turns out that piece of information that's very prevalent in the book is still disputed by the Versace family and is actually
amazing.
Not verified, because the person who says it is a police officer or a detective or something who says that he saw these documents that he should have had no right or ability to see.
Whoa.
Which is why the Versace family is very adamantly against this book. And here's what they say. They say that this book is full of contradictions and hearsay, and a lot of that has to do with that HIV thing. So in the book, she posits that Versace is HIV positive, and that has not been confirmed. And other people who have written books about this have said that it's not true. So it's still – but she puts it out like F-A-C-T.
Oh, yeah, for sure. She does.
Capital fact. I just only know more about it because with the FX show, the Versace family is against the FX show because it's based on this book that they find to be full of contradiction and hearsay, which it is. Like, there's a lot of sources that contradict each other that she includes in the book. And there is a lot of hearsay in the book. It's like, I feel like Versace knew him. Like, I don't know. Yeah, I think so. So she takes her sources, her myriad of sources, and she has some process that she decides who's right and who's wrong, and she goes with it. And it seems like a lot of stuff is, we're not quite sure what the truth is.
Well, and it's like dizzying, and it's part of why I found this book really stressful as reporting. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, I feel like the ground she's standing on is really shaky. Mm-hmm. She's writing about somebody who was a career liar. Like, everything he did was about
lying.
And then it's also about the faultiness of law enforcement, like law enforcement just like dropping everything. And it's about the incredibly wealthy, incredibly powerful, incredibly influential and secretive Versace family.
Sure.
So like you can't trust anybody in this story.
Right.
Like, and I feel like everybody's kind of covering their ass.
Right.
Everybody's speculating. Like, the Versace piece of it is actually totally terrifying. And I'm very curious about the book that is about the mafia conspiracy theories.
Yes, about the connection to that. And the Versace, like the whole book being based on lies and this and that, the only people who are really like super forthcoming with their information are people who we find out later in the book had been paid a lot of money by like hard copy.
Or tabloids. Literally the National Enquirer.
Someone made $85,000 for a story that they made up for the National Enquirer. So like, these are her sources. She doesn't pay them.
That's not presented up front.
It's not presented
up front.
You learn
it on page 30,000.
You learn on page like 500 of 525.
Yeah.
Like, she's like, oh, by the way, everyone I spoke to got paid $1 billion to talk about this. And also that other people chose not to speak because of the money. Like, they didn't want to lie, mm-hmm, et cetera. So like, the people who are the most you know, quoted in the press and stuff. All of these people have made money off of this situation, and they're talking about things that were said to them by a noted liar. Like, the only thing we know for sure about Andrew Cannon is that he lied all the time.
All the time.
Was a pathological liar all the time. Everything he said, he also said the opposite, basically, except for the only thing that he didn't ever talk about was that he didn't have any money.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I know more about this moment reading this book, mm-hmm. but I actually don't know that I know more about what happened necessarily.
Sure. Well, I know a little more because I didn't know. I just knew about the Versace getting shot. I didn't know that he actually killed two of his own close friends, a ex-lover and a estranged best friend. Yeah. So I didn't know that. So I did find those sections, like when she starts talking about what actually happened, the murders, I found that stuff really interesting. Yeah. But also that says a lot about me because I love true crime.
Well, and I actually think the most interesting murder,
yes.
is the third one
with Lee Miglin
or whatever his name is. This wealthy, super wealthy, super influential Chicago guy married to a home shopping network cosmetics
queen.
And the potential, and it's tricky because now I'm like indulging the dark side of Maureen Orth,
right?
But like, you know, there's like so many ways to read that as like, wow, this like wealthy straight influential Chicago guy had like a secret gay, like drug addicted hustler life.
Sure.
But like, it's not, there's not actually ground to stand on with that.
Right.
So am
it's
I like,
all speculation.
It's all speculation. It's totally sensational. It's delicious.
It's delicious.
But it's like a kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
Because
all the people who are in the room are dead now.
Yeah.
Like, so there's no, you know, and then all the people who are speculating are the people who are paid $85,000 to give a picture of Andrew Cannon.
And this book is written at a time that was like so perilously on the threshold between technology and not technology.
Right. There's a part where she says, and then on searches through the World Wide Web.
World Wide Web! I have that highlighted.
I read it out loud to my husband. I was like,
World
Wide
Web.
She just said World Wide Web.
She also is like, I dropped everything. I went to the nearest payphone
and
I called the headquarters of Vanity Fair. And you know, they're like tracking his car phone.
Right.
Like a large piece of it is about car phones
car phone.
And like the elaborate wiring of the car phone. This story would obviously unfold very differently today.
Yeah.
But it's one of the most clumsy things about the story is just like, we're in like technological puberty
sure.
as a nation.
Yeah.
And so just like everything is tough. It's pretty clumsy.
Yeah, it is.
And it comes out in the way she's writing it.
It does. It totally does. And other things that come out in her writing, and I think we talked about this a little bit, but I want to double down on this, on her tone. Because it is a tone. Like, she is...
Will you describe it, Tracy?
Yeah. So I take notes when I read these books, and I just kind of take like little notes, and I put a page number, and I would say maybe four times in my notes it says, does Maureen Orth hate gay people? Is Maureen Orth homophobic?
That's right.
Maureen Orth is grossed out by gayness. And, you know, without slandering this woman, because I don't know if that's true. And also, she is allowed to evolve in the last 20 years, like all of us have, over whatever issues that have come up in pop culture or whatever. But her tone is such that she is commenting on the information.
Yes.
So it's not just that Andrew liked porn, but it's like, she doesn't call it adult film. She calls it porn.
Yep.
You know, it's not pornography. It's porn. And it's like S&M. And it's, she sensationalizes so much of like the sexual stuff in the book. And also she sensationalizes so much of the drug stuff. And she just makes the world that they live in seem so fantastical. And if you didn't know better about like the world, you would think that these gay bars were like
meth dens
where people were having sex like out on top of tables while other people were having sex with other people who were having sex with more people while injecting and drinking and putting in their anuses. Like, I mean, she talks about like all the different ways to ingest meth and like, yeah. you know, in this community, they're called drug addicts, but the gays call them tweakers. And it's just like so dramatic. She's so dramatic. Well,
and it also doesn't feel like she, I feel like one of the things that was really troubling to read it as an authentic American gay person is was that she doesn't, like, yeah, of course there are gay people on meth and there are hustlers and there are bars where people are having sex on pool tables and all of those things. But I feel like it's the world that Andrew Kinnanen doesn't come from, or the world that he comes from isn't painted as a subset, isn't painted as a corner, right. isn't painted as an underground. It's painted as gay people. It's painted as the gays.
Right.
And, you know, like the gays do this, the right. gays do that, which is just like, such a bummer.
Right, it is.
And it, you know, I feel like she gets away with a lot that if you replaced the gays with, say, any race other than white,
right.
you would be like, we're burning this book. And so, you know, it's just like, I can't say that I was offended by the book necessarily, but I can say that, like, if my father in Virginia, who like doesn't have a ton of exposure to a spectrum of gay culture, read this book, he definitely would walk away from it being like, oh yeah, gay people, they all are HIV positive and are drug users and have really dirty sex, and every room they're in they leave behind porn and sex toys,
right? So many sex toys everywhere, like it's just like hanging out of your pocket.
So that's, yeah, that's, it's true, tough.
She gives credence to everything that the people in Andrew Kinnanen's world were doing as the way that all gay people were doing things and are doing things and are programmed to continue to do things.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like she articulates, I think she definitely has a certain empathy for obviously the victims, but also for the sort of community of witnesses and folks adjacent to Kinnanen. But she talks a lot about law enforcement's potential prejudice
sure.
towards gay people and how law enforcement, you know, continues to be like, this isn't a gay thing.
Right.
While simultaneously, like, basically outing people
sure.
in a very devastating way. And the, like, great terror that comes with being outed. But it feels a little hypocritical to me.
Right.
That there's both an articulation of a larger problem in law enforcement, and also just, like, the category of, like, gay crime.
Sure. Well, right. And then she brings up, like, Gacy and Speck and like these other serial right. killers, and she's like, and they were all gay and bisexual, and it's like, wait a second, like
right.
we know from tons of research and, you know, being humans and especially in America, that criminals are of all backgrounds and sexualities and ethnicities, and honestly predominantly heterosexual white men if we're talking about serial yes. killers. So this idea that, like, comparing Andrew Kinnanen to these three, you know, serial killers and saying like, and they're also gay.
Well, I actually
think gay next door could kill you.
Yeah, there's many sentences in the book that begin with statements like, usually in gay crimes.
Right.
And I'm like, gay crimes? Like, if I go rob a bank, that's not actually a gay crime. That's right. just a crime.
That's just a crime
that was executed by a gay person.
Right.
But it, and you know, it's like what we're up against right now with like how people talk about brown people.
Right.
But it's actually hilarious to me. And it's not something that I knew until I read this book, that there is a sort of school of thinking about like what motivates homosexual killers that right. is different than.
Right. But, and so the thing that's interesting, and there's like a fine line, and I'm going to try to connect the dots here. So pray for me. There is the idea that the police don't want to talk about this being a gay thing because it's just a crime. Like you're saying, if you were to rob a bank, it wouldn't be a gay robbing. It would be a bank robbing. But then there's also this part of it where the police are unwilling to let the gay community know that there is someone potentially in Miami
right.
who has killed two, possibly a third gay person, and that they think is in this city, and they're unwilling to actually communicate with the gay community to prevent a future murder. So there's that part that's like, they don't want to say it's a gay thing, but they also know, like, profiling wise, that that's where it's headed. And then there's the part with Maureen Orth, who is so, you know, judgy about gay people. But then this book is the basis of the FX television program by Ryan Murphy, who is a noted gay American male who, if you haven't seen the show, I recommend it just like as more information about this. But the whole premise of this 9-part show is homophobia made us do it, essentially.
Uh-huh.
Like, so Cunanan, like the thesis would be that everything that happened happened because of homophobia. So Cunanan was bullied or felt like he wasn't enough or this and that. And so that led for him to become a murderer, and that the victims, because they were, didn't feel welcomed, and their families, because they were closeted, were unwilling to go forward about Andrew because they were scared that they would get, you know, shunned because of past experience. But it's all this stuff that has to do with like homophobia and authority and back and forth. And I just find it really interesting that the source material for this television show is a book that I find to be so openly, if not homophobic, certainly homophobic-ish.
Uh-huh.
Right? And it's like the police are committing the same crimes against the gay community as Maureen is committing in the book, that this TV show by gay men is purporting to say is the problem.
Well, and it, I mean, it feels like in the TV show, they're like, they're making that the story.
Right. The TV show is all about how homophobia is the reason that these murders happened, which is kind of what they tried to do with the OJ thing, to say that racism is the way, but the line isn't as clear.
Right.
And I think that has to do with the source material being a little skewed. And the show also deviates from the book in certain ways that I found to be like useless, just to perpetuate. Some of it's dumb, but some of it's good, and they have to guess and fill in the blanks where we don't know the answer. So they make choices, which I'm totally fine with, because that's how you make art. But the relationship of homophobia to authority in the book and in the world in this time is just really interesting. And that's the book that I want to read.
Yeah. And I absolutely. And I think, like, you know, the media and our culture at the time made a choice to make this story about homophobia. Maureen Orth has made a choice to make the story a little about homophobia while also being kind of homophobic.
Yes.
But to me, the person at the center of this is, first and foremost, a liar who is ashamed of where he comes from.
Yes.
And that,
where he
to
comes
me,
from financially, yep, specifically.
Yep. And culturally, like, he's half Filipino. Yes, yes, yes. And I think he wishes that he was like a white guy in a braided belt and loafers.
Right.
And so to me, like, the things that pop from the story are actually much more about masculinity in a broad way, mm-hmm, and less about gayness. And maybe that's just because I'm like a homosexual and I'm trying to like pull that out of it. Mm-hmm. But I think that we would look at this guy now more as a serial killer who is working out his dude problems,
sure,
than gay terror, doing gay terror things.
Right. And if this was now, I think that he has all the signs of like that. You know, he is half Filipino, but he erases that from his identity.
For sure.
So much. So what I'm going to say is a little bit not true, but he does have that white male fragility that leads to, you know, school shootings.
Absolutely.
And you know, serial killer, like, he is following the warning signs that we now see when it comes to this kind of behavior, this like lashing out, not because, I mean, he kills his friend and his ex-partner not because of anything aside from that he's like jealous that they aren't obsessed with him anymore.
Yeah, well, and he, it feels like it's absolutely about white male fragility.
Right.
It's all, he is, I feel like he's driven more than anything by entitlement.
Right.
He totally feels like by some like God-given unwritten doctrine, he deserves this life that he, right, did not work for, was not born into, and this access to incredible privileges and resources, which is, I mean, A, disgusting, and mm-hmm, B, it's like straight white male disorder, party of one.
Right.
It actually made me think even a little bit about one of my favorite books about murder, American Psycho.
Oh, sure. We did that. That was the fiction book we did for
book
club.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually love that book.
Yeah, me too.
But this just sort of like rabid, rabid sense of entitlement being the driving force for an enormous amount of terror, to me is both more interesting and I would argue maybe a little more true than gay panic, gay hysteria.
Right, totally. I do wonder though, about the gay hysteria part is like, wonder what it was like to be a gay man at that time, like what it felt like to hear the reporting. Like I know as a Black person, you know, during a lot of the early stages of Black Lives Matter, like people were looking at you to like have the answers or to know why didn't Michael Brown, you know, put his hands up or, you know, whatever it was, or like, why did he yell at the police officer? It's like, well, first of all, I don't know that guy. But second of all, like, why are you coming to me for that? And I wonder if that was a similar thing, like at Thanksgiving, you know, Uncle Bob is like, right. So Michael, you know, you're a gay.
Why did he do it?
Kill five people.
That definitely feels like the moment that she is speaking to.
Right.
And certainly what the culture was thinking at the time, sure. I think. I mean, it's a really interesting moment because it was as AIDS was becoming something that could be thought of as manageable.
Sure.
Or maybe not AIDS, but certainly HIV. And, you know, I think it's really interesting, and this is sort of a footnote in the book, but one of the early speculations of the motive for the murder of Versace was that Versace could have given Cunanan HIV.
Right.
And it was a revenge kill, which is absurd, but also the idea. Cunanan
did not have
HIV. FYI. But the idea that it was a moment in time
that you
where
thought that could be a thing.
Yes.
Like that was like a motive for murder.
Yes. That like HIV was just like absolutely a life destroyer. And I mean, that's, you know, that's real. I mean, I think that even when I was coming out 15 years ago, a huge part of the trauma of that was people being like, well, you're going to get HIV and you're going to die. Truly. Thanks, Grandma.
And congratulations for finding yourself.
Yeah. But you know, I thank God we've evolved as a culture from that. But I think that is a huge piece of it, is just the fear and lack of understanding of what it means to be a gay person. And also how like people are actually different. Like we don't have a secret code. We don't look at each other and know everything about each other.
Gayness is not a monolith. But people still have a hard time with that. Like, and by people, I'm actually speaking directly to white men, and sometimes white women have a hard time with understanding that just like there are 50 different television shows about white lawyers,
right,
and each one is a different lawyer with different passions, that, you know, Filipino people are not all the same and gay men are not all the same. And people who are differently abled are not all the same.
Yeah.
And that, you know, this one man with entitlement and sexuality and ethnic and financial issues committed murder is not an indictment on people who have sex with people of the same gender. Like,
yeah.
Which seems silly that I should have to say this.
Nope.
But like, this book does not say that.
It feels like the rock to stand on after reading this book, for 100%. Sure.
I do want to talk about the title briefly, because after reading the book, I was like, how the fuck did she pick this title? The title is called Vulgar Favors, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. Sam, why don't you talk about the title and then I'll chime in.
Sure. Well, as I recall, vulgar favors is not a phrase that is used at any point in the book. It's not a quote. It's not pulled from anything. So that is Maureen Orth's choice to put an umbrella over the whole thing. Yes, sure. This is the central character in this book is somebody who was fueled by taking things from people.
Sure.
You know, she definitely paints a portrait of him that is somebody who, you know, latched on to older wealthy gay men. And, but the word vulgar is pretty horrible to me.
It is.
Because it really feels like, I mean, it's a judgment. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, like, if we're talking about Cunanan sort of rolling around with these older gay men, first of all, like, I don't think that you can really make a judgment of that unless you're inside of it.
Interesting, like, that's what you think that the vulgar was referring to. I thought it was like about the drugs and stuff.
I think the drugs are attached to it. Sure. But I feel like there's a cycle of doing things for other people to get something.
Sure.
That is not necessarily bad.
Sure.
Maybe you don't have to do like S&M, but right. That doesn't mean that if you do S&M, it's bad.
Right. I just don't think that there are favors in the book. I don't think that trading sex for money is a favor.
Yes.
That's like
an economic
agreement.
It's a transaction. Yes.
Like maybe if you say like transactional relationships as the title of your book, that seems more fair. But a favor is something that someone does for you, like out of like the, to help you.
Yeah. And if Andrew Cunanan is like, I'm going to have sex and give meth to this like rich 70-year-old who's then going to pay my rent for a year. Okay. Like I have some thoughts about that, mm-hmm. but ultimately it's not a favor. Mm-mm. And calling it vulgar is kind of on you. Like right. They actually might be good with that transaction.
Right. Just because you're not into it.
Yeah. And I mean, I had thought much more about the word vulgar than the word favors, but it's so deeply attached to the, I think, both of our larger feelings about the right. book, but it casts a shadow on the everybody in it.
Right. And honestly, it's the perfect title for the book that it's a title that for, she because she wrote a book about being disgusted by a subset of humans is like how she feels, but there's not a favor in the book. And while you might not personally, reader, be super into S&M or, you know, meth or, you know, whatever sexual things or murder, whatever, it doesn't necessarily make it vulgar.
No, it's just like there's a lot of things that happen behind closed doors.
Vulgar is such a judgment call. Also, the subtitle, The Assassination of Gianni Versace, also it was clearly just to sell books because the book is so barely about Versace.
He comes in like 50 pages before the end. Yeah,
it's like he comes in just to get killed, essentially. And, you know, he's brought up a few times earlier on. I also don't necessarily know if I consider it an assassination so much. Like, it didn't seem like it was motivated for political reasons. And I feel like that's kind of what makes something an assassination versus a murder.
It really feels like we're reaching there. Like,
we're reaching there to sell books.
Yeah. And also the various speculations about how Cunanan and Versace were linked, which mm-hmm. is like barely at best.
Right. That's that hearsay that the Versace family is talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know, if you rename the book just like Andrew Cunanan's Killing Spree, feel like you sell just as many books and it seems a little bit more accurate. Or like The Life and Times of Andrew Cunanan, or like The Life and Death, or, you know, this book is about Andrew Cunanan through and through.
For sure.
As it should be, because he is the connecting link between everything. But the title is just so grabby and it's gross. I mean, talk about vulgar. The title is like so just gross and judgy. And after reading when I went into the book, I was thinking like, I'm going to find out about all this like gross, like favors and like, you know, someone paid off so-and-so to kill Versace and this and that. And it's just not supported.
No, well, the only vulgar favors that you actually hear about in the book are the like low-key mention of the Versace family, who, to be clear, is doing some shady stuff.
We are curious. We would like to read that book. So anybody interested writing that book
or in the Versace expose.
Yes. Because there is a Versace book. I can't remember the name. And it contradicts a lot of the Vulgar Favors book. And it talks about a little bit more of Versace's past. But it's also pretty much disputed by a lot of people. Because I believe the Versace family was paid, or there was a large donation made to a charity by them for access to this book.
Even in this book, it's like you hear like 2 weeks or 2 months before Versace was killed, his brother was like charged with bribery in Italy.
Right.
They had the funeral at like the big church in Milan and donated $750,000 to that church. Like that's just like, I Maureen Orth is not talking about the Versace family when she decided to call her book Vulgar Favors.
No. But there might be some vulgar favors there. There might be some favors, at least.
Sure.
Sure. I feel really strong about having spoken about this book. And I think I can like leave this book alone for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Did you have anything that you wanted to add about it?
I don't. I want to, you know, I want to like let our friend Maureen a little off the hook.
Yeah.
Only because I think that it feels so of its time.
It certainly.
And, you know, like if I were teaching this book as part of a class, I would absolutely want to read five other books about homosexual topics.
Sure.
From 1998, 1999. Yeah. Because I think that there is a cultural tone shift that we've undertaken that Maureen,
does not benefit from at this
yeah,
point.
And that like, yeah. like I just like wonder, I wonder what the hindsight is for her on this. Cause I think that you have to read, I mean, I don't know that I would say that I recommend this book necessarily, but I think if you're going to read it, I think you have to read it as a period piece.
Sure.
And both in terms of like what it's talking about, but how it's talking about it.
Yeah, I agree completely. I agree. I actually, to be honest, I kind of enjoy, there are parts of the book that I actually enjoyed reading, but and that was mostly the talking about the crimes and yes. like the describing what happened and talking about the police and those interviews. It, when she starts to contextualize, that's where I was like, no, thank you. Yeah. But it is entertaining. Like I gave this book, I would give this book like 3 stars.
I gave it 3 stars on Goodreads.
Ooh, Goodreads. Follow us on Goodreads. Okay. So I think that's it for now. And by for now, I mean for this week. I will be back next week with my guest, who Sam knows, actually, Vella Lavelle.
Yes.
She's a fantastic actress. And we'll talk, she and I will talk next week. And then the book that she and I are reading is called New Boy by Tracy Chevalier. And it's a retelling of Shakespeare's Othello. So check out that book. And then, of course, Sam. Oh, I always do this. I forgot, you guys. This episode is brought to us by Audible.
Thanks, Audible.
Literally the end. Audible, you can get audiobooks. And if you listen to this show, The Stacks, if you go to www.audibletrial.com/thestacks. You can get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook. So go do that. Yeah, I'm the worst person not having a sponsor because I'm supposed to do it in the middle of the episode. But you know what? Can't please them all.
We love you, Audible.
I'll add it in the beginning. We love you, Audible. And Sam, I love you dearly. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tracy.
And everybody else, we'll see you in the stacks. That does it for us today on The Stacks. Thank you all for listening. Please make sure that you subscribe to The Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. If you listen to us through iTunes, please rate and review the show. Thank you to our sponsor, Audible. To get your free 30-day trial and free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Thank you again to Sam Pinkleton. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite. Our theme music is from Tagirigis. And The Stacks was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. Thank you all so much for listening, and we will see you in the stacks.